bank and as a large municipality for overseeing people's affairs, on the other hand. After 30 years, the security doctrine of the Palestinian security services, consisting of preventing and confronting any armed resistance to the Israeli occupation, has been consolidated since its formation during the Al-Aqsa Intifada under American patronage. The Zionist entity finally finds itself closer than ever to achieving its dream of annexing the West Bank and resolving the conflict with the Palestinians and establishing a so-called Jewish state for its colonial settlers above the West Bank mountains and hills. Serving this context to develop the capabilities of the Palestinian Authority apparatus in the face of the rising resistance in the occupied West Bank, the occupying regime agreed to transfer American weapons and military equipment to the security forces of the authority after the latter accepted a number of Israeli conditions. What reached the Palestinian Authority is seemingly the first payment, which will be worth more than $50 million, out of several payments contingent on Ramallah taking real steps on the ground in the face of the heroic Palestinian resistance, especially in the north of the West Bank and its camps. The Palestinian Authority security forces were also said to have been equipped with advanced technological means to improve their intelligence capabilities by creating an electronic unit which allows those forces to carry out espionage operations and gather intelligence information, including hacking mobile phones, with one target in mind: their brothers in the active Palestinian resistance. Such a shame indeed. On the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. The infamous Oslo has turned 30 years old, yet the so-called peace process brought more Zionist extremists to power in the Israeli entity, such as the so-called Minister of National Security Itamar Ben-Gvir and the Minister of Finance Bezalel Smotrich, while in the occupied territories the capabilities of those who chase the gun and confront the resistance and intellectual is being strengthened. This is not a coincidence at all that Ramallah Authority is now performing all its security roles out in the open, as the paycheck obliges it to do so. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist at the Lebanese daily Al-Akhbar newspaper. Thanks a million for being with us. Mr. Hamza, now, in response to the demands of the Palestinian authorities and on the way to supposedly develop the capabilities of its agencies in confronting the active Palestinian resistance in the occupied West Bank, the occupation entity has agreed that the U.S. send $50 million worth of weaponry for the security forces of the authority after the Israeli entity actually accepted and had a couple of conditions for the PA before sending it. I am literally at awe. I am in fear and in surprise at the audacity of the Palestinian Authority. I mean, they are overtly now playing into the hands of the occupation. Why take this metamorphic decision at this point in time?
Thank you for hosting me. The issue of financing the Palestinian Authority and arming it with weapons which are considered advanced or qualitative weapons are directly in relation to the conditions of the Israeli arming the Palestinian Authority. These conditions are in accordance with the agreement signed between the occupation entity and the Palestinian Authority. Today, the issue is not only limited to confronting the Palestinian resistance, but it has another aspect related to normalization between the entity of occupation and several Arab countries headed by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I say this because one of the conditions set on the path of Saudi-Israeli normalization is to improve the position of the Palestinian Authority and enable it to perform some tasks in addition to the issue of confronting the resistance. Consequently, it is an integrated series of steps that will be implemented slowly, and today this is the first step. Even if the Israeli entity and the Palestinian Authority have denied some details related to the special arms deal for the Palestinian Authority and its quality and transfer of funds to it, however, it seems that the agreements related to preparing the ground to reach the signing of Saudi-Israeli normalization are well underway. And the transfer of funds and weapons to the PA is part of the scene that is being installed.
Mr.
Hamza, the Israeli entity's approval came within, as you explained, a framework which was supposedly agreed upon in the Aqaba summit and the Sharm el-Sheikh summit. It is also being reported that the arrival of the weapons and the equipment to the Palestinian Authority was accelerated after the latest Zionist aggression against the Jenin camp about 3 months ago. It seems like the Aqaba and the Sharm el-Sheikh summit were as if a renewal of the infamous Oslo Accord, which happened in the early 90s. How do you perceive the Palestinian resistance will reply to such a movement after these summits?
There is no agreement with the Israeli occupation entity unless its declared or hidden goal is to try to pressure the resistance and target the existence of the resistance. Therefore, the Aqaba summit, the Sharm el-Sheikh summit, and others are annexes, so to speak, to the Oslo Accords, which laid the foundation stone from the viewpoint of normalizers for the attempt to end and eliminate the Palestinian cause. But despite this, we see today that the Palestinian resistance, in particular, is growing in its capabilities and diversifying its options and operational performance on the ground. We see, for example, in the Jenin operation, ambushes against Israeli armored vehicles and the setting of complex ambushes that require complicated levels of work on the ground, such as monitoring, planting ambushes, and then clashing with many forces that have different and varied tasks. This is considered a qualitative shift within the West Bank in the path of resistance. Therefore, today we see the resistance response to these operations and these political paths opened by the occupying entity under the auspices of the United States of America. We see them with more interconnection within the arenas of resistance by the delicate coordination between these resistance forces on the one hand and the specific leaps that the resistance is taking on the ground, whether in the West Bank, Al-Quds, or the 1948 territories. We also see the development of the resistance in Gaza and in southern Lebanon, which has accumulated great experiences. An example of this is a simple tent that the resistance in Lebanon set up inside the occupied Sheba farms, where to the day the occupying entity has not been able to remove it or even approach it.
Maybe basically that's why the Israeli entity was happy in seeing American-made weapons go to the Palestinian Authority despite the risks that it may convey to the Zionist entity itself, because we heard Israeli entity army radio, because when we have PA, when the Palestinian Authority says, no, this is not how it happens, we then again read it in the Israeli media. For example, the Israeli entity army radio revealed details about this case with their correspondent, whose name is Doron Kadush. He quoted Palestinian security sources claiming that the PA has received automatic weapons, up to 1,500 pieces, some of them M16s and some of them Kalashnikovs from the U.S. stores. So many questions come here to my mind at the moment, but the most important is the route of weapons for the Palestinian resistance. In the event it is affected by this new audacious Palestinian authority move, what options does the resistance still have to survive?
In addition to what you mentioned about the Kalashnikov, the M16, or other automatic rifles, there is also talk about trying to train members of the Palestinian security forces affiliated with the Palestinian Authority in modern techniques used in espionage, gathering information, and uncovering resistance cells that the Zionists call in their literature terrorist cells. This also comes on behalf of the Israeli occupation entity, because everyone saw the Zionist involvement inside the West Bank and in Jenin, especially after the failed attempt to storm the Jenin camp. Because of all these matters, the Israeli occupation entity needs the Palestinian Authority to be able to carry out tasks on its behalf. Today, there are fears being raised through the Zionist media that these weapons may fall into the hands of other parties, by which they mean the Palestinian resistance, and thus the resistance might benefit from them in confronting the Israeli occupation entity.
Well, it depends on how these weapons will be used, and I'm pretty sure if they are used wrongly, the Palestinian resistance will have a huge say in this. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Khanza, journalist at the Lebanese Daily Al-Akhbar, for joining us to discuss this very crucial matter on the 30th anniversary of the infamous Oslo Agreement. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about a new batch of sanctions against Iran, and Press TV has a piece in it.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Now, the U.S. Treasury Department, or what I like to call the financial police of the empire, introduced on Friday new sanctions against 29 Iranian individuals and entities, including 18 security officials and three state-sponsored news outlets, including Press TV, for alleged suppression of anti-Iran protests a year ago. Now, the new set of unilateral punitive measures were coordinated with the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and other so-called U.S. partners, as per a release issued by the Treasury. Now, more details in this following report.
Iran has strongly condemned the United States of America and its allies for imposing a new batch of fresh unilateral punitive measures against the Islamic Republic of Iran over the country's defense of its security and nation in the face of Western-backed riots that spread throughout the country last year. On Friday, September 15, the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and the European Union sanctioned dozens of Iranian individuals and entities, which they accused of either suppression or misrepresentation of last year's unrest. According to the release of the U.S. Treasury, the sanctions target key members of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps and law enforcement forces, the head of the prison's organization, three individuals, and one company allegedly involved in assisting with censorship and blocking of internet access, three government-sponsored media outlets, Fars News, Tasnim News, and Press TV, and three senior media officials. In the same context, the UK government also announced on Friday sanctions targeting several Iranian officials, including the culture minister and the mayor of Tehran. The audacity of these self-proclaimed world police, who never look into their own reflection in the mirror, not only lies in their actions, but the excuses they give to said illegal punitive actions. For instance, the UK's Foreign, Commonwealth and Development Office said the new measures focus on senior Iranian decision-makers responsible for drafting and implementing Iran's mandatory hijab legislation. Ever wonder why they never sanction France for banning the hijab altogether? Because this is not only a war against the Islamic Republic of Iran, but a war against Islam and its teachings as well. This new batch of sanctions comes on the eve of the first anniversary of the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, whose death sparked Western-backed funded riots and armed insurgencies inside Iran, with incitement also coming from Western media outlets with the aim of undermining the nation. Anti-Iran rioters claim Amini died after she was beaten under police custody for an alleged breach of the country's dress code for women. However, Iran's legal medicine organization has confirmed that her cause of death was from complications she endured as a result of a craniopharyngioma surgery at the age of 8, dismissing allegations that she had been beaten by police forces. Iran's adversaries' intentions to isolate it have so far failed, since everyone can witness the country's wide political and economic relations with nations ranging from the Far East to Africa and Latin America. Now, putting us at Press TV on that list of Western wicked violation of human rights, violation of free trade, and violation of freedom of expression gives us great pride to be a voice of the truth that the West adamantly tries to silence but utterly fails yet again. Press TV proudly shall remain the voice of the voiceless.
Well, to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Ms. Maryam Saleh in Beirut, university lecturer. It's a pleasure having you on board, Maryam, to discuss this issue. So we are now on the first anniversary of the death of Iranian Mahsa Amini, whose death was ruled by medical officials and professionals as being a result of a health complication. We see the West collectively come together once again to try and punish Iran at the level of its security, economy, technology, and even media for simply defending its national security and territorial integrity against systematic Western attacks once again. Now, as a media professional yourself, how effective do you view these attempts to try to control the narrative in favor of the Western schemes, if I may, against the Islamic Republic of Iran?
Well, these Western schemes, first, thank you for having me, Marwa, and it's great to be here. These Western schemes continue for, this is a decades-long battle, actually. This is not new. The U.S. has continued and tried everything from the beginning, from the success of the revolution in 1979, and they were continuously creating this rhetoric, launching campaigns, launching sanctions against the Islamic Republic. So therefore, this is not new. And now it is not only targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran, it is targeting any country that stands with the Islamic Republic and goes by its stances of course, fight against oppression and injustice and so on and so forth. So basically, we can see for those who do actually read, those who do follow up, those who want the news to come to them, they will be searching for it and they will be reaching it. Of course, they are successful somewhat in basically creating this blackout, perhaps for those who are in the United States, perhaps those who are in the Western world in general. They don't have enough access to alternative media. They don't have that access to be able to get the other side of the story. Even websites are blocked. And so it's crazy in a world where we have such all this technology, where we should be capable of reaching every single person in the entire globe. You still cannot reach everyone, but of course you still do have a lot of people who are critical, but unfortunately they are still few. There are few people who are critical of their country's politics, the few people who want to get to the story. But of course, when you come and see what's happening, they are in control somewhat, but when you see how crazy it is, it's this double standards. Mm-hmm. We have mass killings by the police in the United States. You have killings in France. You have all this oppression also in the Western world. And the fact that freedom of speech is actually being distorted, the word freedom of speech, you are not allowed to speak about Islam and the Quran, but you're allowed to speak about other issues that would lead to chaos and would lead to corruption of the entire society. So basically, they do have that control in several areas, but at the same time, you have this part of the world. You have those people, even in other parts of the world, who are raising awareness, who are educating people on a daily basis, and we do know them. We have a lot of figures in the Western world, both in the Americas, and you have a lot of countries that are resisting bit by bit.
Maryam, you yourself, being part of Press TV's team since it was launched in 2007, and I find it crucial for the audience to hear it firsthand, coming from a highly respected journalist and a colleague that I personally learned a lot from, what does it mean to you to see Press TV targeted like this by the Western illegal punitive measures, while knowing that on a daily basis our work at Press TV focuses on seeking out the truth while they are killing the truth, aka you have the biggest journalist that has been under oppression for more than 10 years right now, Julian Assange, in prison, and he's about to be sentenced for like 150 years, and they say nothing about it.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. And this is a big injustice, actually. This is a huge injustice. So when we began in 2007, we clearly said we're going to give a platform for everyone. It's true that we are focusing on what is happening, on all the injustice, all the aggressive policies against the Palestinians, which is a primary issue for us. It's a priority. But we are even giving platform to Zionists. We were allowing everyone to give their take, making sure that we were not like Western media. We're not silencing anyone. And we even, for example, in 2007, you probably know the mayhem that was in Lebanon, all the political complications. We still, those who were anti, for example, resistance, we gave them a platform. We made sure that we get their opinion, as we get the opinion of resistance supporters on our platform as well. We also spoke to everyone else. So therefore, we were quite surprised when we saw in the beginning, even before this, this is not the first form of sanctions. We had previous sanctions when we were taking down satellites, we were taking down websites. Our websites were closed, especially by the United States, of course, administration. That was the main side that is fighting against the media, which is really successful. And I think that the main reason why they are targeting Press TV and those media outlets in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and perhaps in turn as they are doing in other countries, as in Lebanon, it is mainly because they are succeeding and reaching out to those who do want the truth. And like I said, we all want the truth. We had correspondents in every single corner of the world. Mm-hmm. And those correspondents were always under attack. They were always censored. They were always not given permission.
We
were not allowed.
Life for the truth. If you remember our own Serena Shim, who gave her life to show the world that the World Health Organization was bringing weapons and insurgents into Syria, and she never came back to her family.
Exactly. That was one of the facets of the truth that we were trying to show. And still, she paid her life for that sake. Her family lost her, but she knew that this was a message that she needed to take out. And this is what our journalists are doing every day. We also had another journalist who was killed directly by Daesh in Syria as well. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we are always journalists that are ready to seek the truth, as you said, no matter what the cost. And that is what is surprising, because like I said, we're trying to make sure that the truth comes out to everyone, and it seems that Press TV was quite successful in this very clearly. And this is when you see that the United States is fighting you and targeting you, that means that you are on the right track. And this is something that we learned
That's
throughout the years.
100% right. But as a media and communications lecturer yourself, what really raises concern for me is the power that our enemy has against us. And do you think that such an approach will oblige the international community, especially the global South communities, to adopt maybe the Western culture of journalism because they are afraid that they might face something like Press TV have been facing?
Well, unfortunately, you do have a lot of media outlets that are forced to do that. And when you come and look at what media is about, you have a lot of critical analysts that stress that what media is all about in the last decades, especially since the fact that we had a uniformal method when it comes to media, it's mainly to create ideologies. And they're not just, and in order to do that, they need to distort and destroy other ideologies, people's cultures, people's identities. And that is what they have been doing in all those decades, especially after the victory of the revolution in the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979. So that was their main issue or main objective. And that was not only done in our part of the world, that was done also in other parts of the world. They are trying to create those ideologies, and through that, they incite hatred, they incite stereotyping, and this is something we saw firsthand. I grew up in the United States. I saw how people looked at Lebanon. Oh, those poor, unfortunate people, they have to be living under terrorists. And they did not know that we were living under Israeli occupation that was supported by the United States administration. Mm-hmm. And that is something that we need to let out to the rest of the world. And still, we have a lot of people who are ignorant to those ideas and those that reality. And this would probably take a lot of time and more time, but we are getting there somehow.
Definitely. with people like you, Mariam. Ladies and gents, Mariam Saleh, university lecturer and a dear colleague and friend. With people like her, we make sure that the voices of the voiceless is always heard. I want to thank you very much, Mariam, for being with us in this segment to talk about the new batch of sanctions against us. Ladies and gents, thank you very much. Stay tuned next week for more updates from West Asia right here on the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. In the United States, former President Donald Trump has again argued for federal judge Tanya Chutkan's recusal from the January 6th case. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump's defense team filed papers on Sunday night, 17th of September, in further support of his request that Judge Tanya Chutkan recuse herself in the federal 2020 election conspiracy case brought by special counsel Jack Smith in Washington, D.C. In doing so, Donald Trump lawyers met the Sunday deadline set by Judge Chutkan to formally respond to Jack Smith's opposition to the request. Jack Smith, in a court filing on Friday, argued that Judge Chutkan should remain on the case. Trump's lawyers again argued that Judge Tanya Chutkan has made disqualifying statements critical of Donald Trump during her handling of the sentencing of two January 6 defendants. In their latest arguments, submitted in Washington, D.C. federal court, Trump's defense team argued, "These proceedings are indeed historic. The public interest is not in the perception of a rush to judgment or a show trial contaminated by the appearance of a partial presiding judge." Trump's attorneys have requested Judge Tanya Chutkan's recusal in the former president's election interference case, based on previous statements that she made in two separate Capitol riot sentencing hearings. They highlighted her comment to one Capitol riot defendant in October of 2022, that the violent attempt to stop the certification of Joe Biden's election came from blind loyalty to one person who, by the way, remains free to this day. They argued that this statement suggests an apparent prejudgment of guilt. But government attorneys denied this was the case and said Judge Tanya Chutkan's remarks were factually accurate and responsive to arguments presented to the court of law. The Trump attorneys also referred to a statement that Judge Chutkan made in a hearing about Trump White House records in late 2021, in which she said, "A president is not a king, and that Trump is not president." Trump's defense argued that the public must have confidence that President Trump's constitutional rights are being protected by an unbiased judicial officer. No president is a king, but every president is a U.S. citizen entitled to the protections and rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. Donald Trump's lawyers are also seeking a formal hearing on this matter. Ultimately, it is up to Judge Tanya Chutkan to decide whether her past statements create the perception of bias. A new judge would be assigned to the case if she recuses herself. Trump's attorneys could petition an appeals court to require her to recuse, but such efforts are often not successful. There is no specific timetable for Judge Chutkan to rule on Donald Trump's request. Cable broadcaster CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump's legal team again argued on Sunday, 17th of September, that U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan should recuse herself from the 2020 election criminal case against him in Washington, D.C. Donald Trump has argued this before, and his response on Sunday was expected. But the language in Trump's legal argument used Judge Chutkan's own words against her and argued in a particularly bold way that Trump's political successes meant the prosecution of him could be perceived as potentially biased. And Judge Tanya Chutkan, a harsh judge on 6th of January riot cases, should no longer preside. The public must have confidence that President Trump's constitutional rights are being protected by an unbiased judicial officer. No president is a king, but every president is a United States citizen entitled to the protections and rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution, Trump's lawyers wrote in a Sunday night court filing. Judge Tanya Chutkan used the phrase "presidents are not kings" in denying a Trump bid to block House investigators from obtaining his presidential records. First written by Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, now a Supreme Court justice, in a previous Trump lawsuit, the phrase has become well known as part of Judge Chutkan's jurisprudence. Judge Tanya Chutkan will ultimately make the decision on whether she should relinquish the case, and while Trump's ask is a long shot based on the law, his filings on the topic could be used in appeals if he's convicted. Recusal requests like these are often fraught, given that a defendant must question the judge who presides over their trial and that the standard to force a recusal is very high. Such attempts are largely unsuccessful. Yet Donald Trump has been undeterred in recent days, attacking the case against him in the federal system and questioning Judge Tanya Chutkan's fairness in court papers. His court filings have been more direct in questioning the judge, even while Justice Department officials argue there is nothing that Judge Chutkan has done to show that she was improper in handling other January 6 cases. The core value at issue here is whether the public will accept these proceedings as legitimate or instead view them as a politically motivated effort by the incumbent administration to take out its most significant political opponent in a presidential campaign. The opponent who, by the way, is not only free, but has a strong lead in the opinion polls. Trump's legal team wrote, "Public confidence is not an insignificant consideration. It is the consideration," they continued. "No system of justice can survive if its citizens lose faith in it." At the same time, Donald Trump faces a request from federal prosecutors for Judge Chutkan to further limit his public speaking about the case and possible witnesses because, they say, his attacks on social media platforms have caused harassment. The judge is still weighing that request as well.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witches.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Hit me. Please.
We the people.
Occupy Wall Street was a movement against economic inequality, political corruption, the influence of money and the elite in politics, and the plight of the 99% versus the wealthy 1%. In September 2011, this grassroots movement drew people from different backgrounds to Zuccotti Park, located in Financial District in Lower Manhattan. Protesters demanded accountability for the 2008 U.S. financial crisis, criticizing Wall Street firms and large corporations for their role in the economic downturn. The movement died down relatively quickly, but Occupy Wall Street remains a symbol of grassroots activism in the United States. Occupy Wall Street. In the heart of New York City's financial district, a grassroots movement known as the Occupy Wall Street emerged in September 2011. The movement's primary aim was to address economic inequality and corporate influence in politics. Occupy Wall Street gained momentum through the use of social media, drawing in people from diverse backgrounds, camping out at Zuccotti Park in Manhattan, and refusing to leave. They criticized Wall Street firms and large corporations for their role in the 2008 economic crisis. The movement resonated with many Americans who felt left behind by a system they viewed as favoring the wealthy elite. Occupy Wall Street used the slogan, "We're the 99%, to highlight the vast wealth gap in the United States.
All the rich people are just hogging all their money and not giving any of it to people who actually need it.
They're out here, the 99%, and the 1% is controlling everything, financially everything. And that should not happen. Free up the jobs so people could work, economy could rise.
The "we are the 99% phrase encapsulated the idea that most Americans were struggling while a small percentage enjoyed immense wealth. The protests spread to other cities, with similar encampments and demonstrations taking place across the nation. Occupy movements address various issues mostly relating to the economy, including student loan debt, healthcare, and affordable housing.
Occupy Wall Street, most people who have examined it closely believe that it was a response to the 2008 crash, that the issue of the neoliberal economic order was beginning to come to bear on the working class and the working poor. Many people associated with Occupy Wall Street were young people who had traditionally believed that they had the opportunity to have a better and more fruitful economic life than their parents. They were coming to the stark realization that the economic order that the United States Empire advocates and, in fact, enforces around the world was not in their best interest. So I don't believe they had a plan or they had a realistic idea of how to address their grievances, but they were angry. So it was an expression of anger. They moved into a number of parks and they attempted to act out against the government. Unfortunately, they didn't have a realistic plan. But yes, it was a response to the 2008 crash. And of course, I have to add this. It wasn't just the crash. It was the response to the crash. Because after the 2008 economic crash, there were two particular groups that had suffered. That would be the working class and the working poor. And of course, the extremely wealthy who owned the banks. And what they saw was that the government acted to relieve the economic burden of the super rich and did nothing to relieve the economic burden of the average working class person. And I believe that's what angered them.
The Occupy Wall Street movement began in September 2011 when protesters first occupied Zuccotti Park in New York City. The duration of the movement varied from city to city and camp to camp. In the case of the original Zuccotti Park occupation in New York City, It lasted for about 2 months. The protesters were eventually evicted from the park by authorities in mid-November 2011. What were the key motivations and goals of the Occupy Wall Street movement?
2011, the USA was still reeling from the aftermath of the financial meltdown of 2008 and 2009. And at the same time, there was a feeling that there needed to be some economic reforms in the United States to secure Americans the right to health care and jobs and education and regulate Wall Street transactions and Wall Street lending practices to offset the effects of the crisis and perhaps prevent another one from happening. However, there was a lot of opposition to that from the Republicans that had formed the Tea Party. And so it seemed that Occupy Wall Street was an attempt by those who wanted Wall Street to be regulated and wanted more economic reforms and wanted accountability from Wall Street and from the wealthy for the financial crisis to mobilize. And it ended up being a movement of hundreds of thousands of people, not just in New York City, but all across the United States, who moved into action and, you know, occupied public spaces, engaged in civil disobedience and arrests because they wanted Wall Street to be held accountable for the financial crisis, and they wanted some regulation and economic reforms.
Occupy Wall Street had its roots in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. The economic downturn had profound effects on millions of Americans, leading to job losses, home foreclosures, and growing sense of economic disparity. Frustration was brewing among the working and middle-class citizens who felt that the financial institutions responsible for the crisis had escaped accountability.
So let's not forget, it was a massive movement, and local groups often had to express different goals. But we can still pinpoint that its prime common concerns is how large corporations and the global financial system control the world in a way that benefits the infamous 1% or even 0.1%, undermines democracies and causes instability. So let's not forget that the slogan of the movement was "We are the 99%," and the hashtag was "Occupy," of course.
Across the United States, the Occupy protests continued for several months, with some camps lasting longer than others. However, by early 2012, many of the physical encampments had been disbanded or had significantly diminished in size. While the physical occupations had a relatively short lifespan, the impact of the Occupy Wall Street movement on public discourse and activism persisted well beyond the time when the physical camps were active. What was the government response to the movement?
The government response initially was an attempt to take it over. At the time that Occupy Wall Street happened, I was doing some work on Capitol Hill with some people who were directly related to members of Congress. In fact, members of Congress and their representatives went to the locations. There were two, in fact, in Washington, D.C. There were a number of locations around the nation, not just in New York City, where there were the Occupy Wall Street movement had set up camps. So members of Congress, members of the ruling elite, actually sent their emissaries out to talk to the people to try to, in my opinion, to co-opt the movement, to go out there and basically say, what do you want? Let's move this anger into Congress, and let's trust Congress to act, to alleviate, to address your grievances. The people at Occupy Wall Street were not having it. They did not trust the members of Congress. They did not trust the members of the ruling elite. So they rejected the overtures by the congressional staffers and congressional emissaries.
The initial call for protests came from a Canadian anti-consumerist magazine called Adbusters. Callie Lenz, an activist and co-founder of the magazine, called for a protest and a million-man march on Wall Street in February 2011. The actual protests, sit-ins and camping, came in September, and other groups and people joined the movement in mass when it gained some momentum and media attention.
Much of the protesters' anger is directed at the banks and financial industry. Several people went to a Citibank branch in New York where they planned to withdraw their money and leave, but the police were on the scene quickly and arrested about 20 people. Zuccotti Park is the birthplace of what is now a worldwide movement. This is where the call for global action originated. In Washington, large crowds gathered around the Martin Luther King Memorial. Demonstrators voiced their frustration with the country's stagnant economy and urged the government to take action to create jobs.
That is unacceptable, not in this country, and not when these corporate fat cats are getting away with billions and billions of dollars.
After almost 2 months of protests, ironically, one of the world's richest people, the New York City mayor, Michael Bloomberg, ordered the city police to forcibly remove protesters and clear the park. Many were arrested and many more were pepper sprayed. The New York City Police Department was accused of using police brutality against the Occupy Wall Street protesters.
Well, on the one hand, it seemed like the Obama administration was vocally supporting the Occupy Wall Street protests. Barack Obama, when he was dedicating the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial during the Occupy protests, he said that if Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. were alive today, he would be at Occupy Wall Street. Nancy Pelosi and other elected officials said they thought Occupy Wall Street was great. But we also know at the same time they were coordinating a national security crackdown on the protests. There were calls with the mayors of major cities, the Department of Homeland Security, and the FBI not only heavily infiltrated the protests, but secured the arrest. There were many people that were arrested, beaten up, and injured. There were many protesters who spent time in prison. The most famous of which was probably Cecily McMillan, a friend of mine who ended up going to Rikers Island for almost a year simply because a police officer sexually assaulted her and she jumped in reaction. There was a heavy police crackdown. A lot of people were beaten up. A lot of people were maced in the face with pepper spray. There was a veteran in Oakland, California, who was shot in the head with a rubber bullet and sustained, permanent damage, to his ability to speak and his nerves as a result of that. There were many cases that involved various people that were brutalized, beaten up, injured, spent time in jail, etc.
The Occupy Wall Street movement did not have a single set of demands, but rather a range of concerns that resonated with a broad cross-section of society. However, some of the common themes and demands that emerged were about income inequality, corporate influence in politics, accountability for financial institutions, and social and economic justice. What were some of the criticisms aimed at the Occupy Wall Street movement?
They did not have a plan. They had no structure. They attempted to act in an anarchical way, and they didn't. So since they didn't have a plan, they didn't know what they were trying to accomplish. They were just acting out in anger. When people talked to them about, coming up with a plan or doing something, they were unable to really advocate for anything concrete. They were unable to say these are the changes we want, or these are the rules or regulations that we want changed. They were basically acting out in anger. One of the issues, main problems that they had was they decided to have kind of a informal governmental structure. And when they decided to do something, they would take a vote. And the vote had to be unanimous, which meant that they were rarely able to accomplish anything. There are many of us who believe that there were government infiltrators. And if you look at the history of the intelligence community in the United States, it would be hard to believe that there weren't government infiltrators into the movement who acted to disrupt it, acted to create chaos. But the reality of the Occupy movement was it was an acting out in anger. So they did not have a plan. And they did not have goals. They knew they were angry. And so it was a movement that was destined to, at some point, flop, at some point, to run out of steam because they didn't know what they want. They didn't know where they were going. That was their, to me, that was their biggest problem, not knowing where they were going or what they really wanted to do.
After the spark of protests in New York, a wave of demonstrations started across the United States. Occupy encampments popped up and were set in major cities and towns, drawing diverse group of people who were angry and fed up with their economic state and blamed major corporations and the U.S. politicians who mostly came to power through the support of Wall Street and major corporations.
Shortly after midnight, more than 1,000 police dressed in riot gear filled the streets of downtown New York, moving in on the Occupy Wall Street camp, bringing heavy equipment and a no-nonsense attitude.
All persons must temporarily leave the park. If you refuse to immediately remove your property from the park or refuse to leave the park, you'll be subject to arrest.
Some experts believe that the lack of leadership in the Occupy Wall Street movement was one of the major factors that it died down relatively young. However, it impacted the 2012 presidential election, and politicians had to at least pretend that they understood the people's concerns. Candidates from both major parties were addressing issues like income equality and corporate influence in their campaign.
I would say the biggest internal problem was that there was a lot of foundation money pouring in from liberal Zionist NGOs like the Ford Foundation and entities that are tied to the U.S. The National Endowment for Democracy and to George Soros, and that there were a lot of people that were being paid to be part of the Occupy Wall Street protest, and as a result, they were very careful to guide it in ways that it was not a threat to the U.S. power structure. At the time Occupy Wall Street was taking place, Libya was being bombed by the United States and NATO. There was almost no talk of that in the Occupy Wall Street protest movement whatsoever. There was an attempt to link the Occupy Wall Street protest movement with the call from Zionist settlers for more expansion of the settlements. There was also an attempt to link Occupy Wall Street with the efforts to destabilize Libya and Syria and Iran and Russia and China and other countries and link it with the color revolution apparatus from around the world. That was the main internal problem, the main external problem.
The Occupy Wall Street movement also had a ripple effect beyond the borders of the United States. Protests inspired by the movement occurred in numerous countries, especially Western nations such as the United Kingdom, Canada, Spain, and Australia. These global protests were often linked by shared sentiment of economic inequality and discontent with political elites. The international response demonstrated the interconnectedness of social and economic issues in the world.
You know, I can't say that the Occupy Wall Street movement itself inspired similar movements around the world. I can say that I believe that one of the things that happened as a result of 2008 and to some extent the pushback in 2008, the anger over the response of a neoliberal government, which decided that when the banks crashed and the people crashed economically, that this government would bail the banks out and leave the people to suffer.
The U.S. that prides itself and poses as a beacon for freedom of speech witnessed major police crackdown on Occupy Wall Street demonstrators. In New York, the police used excessive force in removing the protesters, camping at Zuccotti Park, destroying and throwing out close to 6,000 of people's library books that were set up in the camp, containing books which were mostly donated by people for the public to read.
I would say that the main movement died quite fast, okay? By February 2012, the main places like London, Washington, D.C., as I said, maybe 5 minutes before, just died out. So the main movement did not last very long. And what factors contributed to its decline in prominence? I would say the celebration of horizontality, the absence of leaders, and maybe a certain infiltration by the FBI quite soon within the movement, let's say during the first months.
In Boston, Massachusetts, the police arrested hundreds of demonstrators during the occupation of Dewey Square, and in Los Angeles, California, at least 200 people were arrested when the LAPD cleared the occupied LA encampment around the city hall. What made the movement lose prominence?
Well, I think the main reason it declined in prominence was the Democrats no longer found it useful. The Democrats used it to get the energy going in the lead up to the 2012 elections. I was part of the protests that happened in Charlotte, North Carolina. I remember how, during those protests, Barack Obama and the Democratic Party very much wanted Occupy Wall Street tents and Occupy Wall Street encampment to be set up near the Democrat convention so they could film it. And they very much wanted to use the energy of the Occupy Wall Street movement to defeat the Republicans in 2012. The Republicans had their mass movement called the Tea Party. And so in order to maintain a kind of a populist image and the idea that they were fighting for the working class, the Democrats had to kind of create the aesthetic or the illusion that they were building a mass movement as well. And Occupy Wall Street served that purpose for the Democratic Party. And after that, it didn't really have a reason to exist. There was, again, a lack of ideology, a lack of any clear demands or central authority. And so because of that, it was able to just kind of fade away almost as instantly as it had sprung up, and that the role of Silicon Valley and social media in both creating Occupy Wall Street and then deleting Occupy Wall Street from the conversation cannot be overlooked. There was a huge amount of manipulation by the social media tech giants to create and destroy Occupy Wall Street for their own purposes.
The Occupy Wall Street movement that began in September 2011 in New York City marked a significant moment in contemporary social and political activism. It was a protest that ignited discussions on economic inequality, corporate influence in politics, and the concentration of wealth. Some politicians like Bernie Sanders tried to run on the waves of such movements, but were unsuccessful partly because they are part of the establishment and millionaires themselves.
Well, the one thing that the Occupy movement was able to do was it was able to redirect the discourse to economic prosperity and bring the conversation out about oligarchy. One of the things that they talked about was the 99%, basically being the working class, the working poor, and the poor versus the 1%, the extremely wealthy. And in creating that conversation, particularly in a country like the United States that pushes a neoliberal economic order and a very oppressive economic order, in bringing out a conversation that pitted the majority of the people against a small, dominant, ruling elite, that then created new conversations about addressing the income inequality. Before the income inequality wasn't part of a discussion, they brought it out. Their discussion about the 99% versus the 1% changed the discourse. So I think it was very healthy. It was a very good thing to happen. It was a movement. Maybe it wasn't destined to be able to make a change as a group or as a movement, but it did change the conversation to the 99% versus the 1%. And of course,
the Occupy Wall Street movement, while no longer physically present in Zuccotti Park, sparked important conversations and drew attention to the issues of income inequality and corporate power in the United States. Its legacy continues to influence discussions on economic justice and the role of financial institutions in shaping society. However, 12 years since its inception, large corporate banks are still being bailed out by the government, they're running on greed, and have no responsibility toward the society.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the Limelight.
In the United States, data released recently shows Southern Nevada's rates of homelessness spiked to alarming levels, the largest amount counted in a decade, underscoring Nevada's homeless and housing crisis. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. The iconic Las Vegas Strip has seen a surge in homeless people sleeping on the sidewalks and in makeshift tents as the city